This evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about two aspects of the practice, two aspects of the meditation, and these are called concentration and insight. And the meditation practice that we're doing has these two aspects to it, and it might be helpful to look at these two aspects and perhaps get a little bit more understanding of why we're here and what it is that we're doing with all this. So the first one is concentration. I remember when I was much younger and growing up in Canada, there's a tradition in Canada of the cowboys having rodeos. I don't know how many of you are. Some of you will be familiar with rodeos and some of you may not be. But a rodeo is a gathering of the cowboys and they come together to have all these different competitions. And they see who's the best horseback rider and the best lasso thrower, the best rope thrower and the best bullfighter and all these different contests. And one of the contests is riding the bucking bronco. And the bucking bronco is a wild horse. And what they do with this horse, the cowboys, they take turns riding these bucking broncos to see who can stay on the longest. And they have to just hold on with one hand. They're only allowed to hold on with one hand. One hand has to be up in the air. And it's quite dangerous. Lots of cowboys get quite seriously injured. But what they do, they start out the competition by putting the horse in a very small pen. So the horse is enclosed on all four sides and there's just enough room for the horse to stand up in this pen. And then the cowboy climbs up the side of this pen and jumps down onto the horse. And the horse immediately starts bucking and stomping and snorting and kicking at the pen, trying to escape and raising a real fuss. But because of the construction of the pen, the horse can't get out. It just can't go anywhere. And because of this, it just gets more and more frustrated and furious and bucks more and more and tosses around. And then finally they start the stopwatch and they suddenly open the gate and the horse runs out and jumps and bucks and twists and turns until the cowboy is thrown off. And I remember noticing this, and I remember noticing that quite often what happened when the cowboy got thrown off was that the horse would immediately settle down. And the bucking and the tossing and snorting and twisting would all just stop. The horse is out of the pen, the cowboy is gone, and the horse settles down. And then sometimes what it seemed they were doing, before the horse had a chance to settle down, in order to put on a bit of a show, they would have some clowns come running out, and the clowns would start throwing things at the horse and start waving bright colors at it in order to keep it bucking. And it seems to me on reflection now that concentration, the developing of concentration, works in similar ways. And there's two types of concentration. And the first type of concentration I can connect with this horse being in the pen and not being able to go anywhere and just being cornered. And there's a type of concentration that we can develop by using very strong willpower and very strong effort to pen in the mind, to fix the point on a single object so that everything else is blocked out and the mind is trapped in that one point. And in developing this kind of concentration and having this kind of concentration, there can come with being rigidly fixed on that one point a real sense of calmness. And there can be a real sense of peace, and it can be a very pleasant sensation. But underlying it is this tension, this forcing. And so this type of concentration is very much dependent on the conditions of this forcing and this blocking out of everything. And in the practice, there are situations and there are people for whom, and there are times when this type of concentration can be of some use. But in the practice here, in what we're doing here, this isn't the type of concentration that we're working on, that we're developing. The meditation that we've been doing so far has been primarily concerned with concentration, the observation of the breath, being with the touch sensation, the walking meditation, feeling the contact of the feet on the ground. All of this primarily up to this point has been for the development of concentration. But the type of concentration here is the type of calmness and quietness that comes when there's freedom from this pan, when the horse isn't being forced to stay in this pan, when the rider is gone, and there's lots of space, there's a wide open field, and there's no need to struggle anymore, there's no need to fight, there's no need to hold on to anything. And in those circumstances, then the horse can settle down and rest. And so with the mind, so in watching our breath and also the body, in working with the breath, what we're doing is just observing the breath and just experiencing the breath and using it as a reference point to come back to. And when other things arise, we don't block them out, we don't reject them, and we don't latch on to them. And we observe them, we experience them, we know that they're there, we acknowledge that they're there, and very gently we come back to the breath. And what this does is it allows for a being with the breath that can be very calm and very peaceful, and it can have a very pleasant feeling. But what it also has is qualities of allowing other things to be present, and of accommodating other things, of being able to be with whatever is there, to allow whatever comes up to come up, and not to react to it, to just see it as it is, and then come back to the breath. So there's a real feeling of being very settled and very centered and very calm and quiet and still. I don't know, some of you may not have experienced this, but it can happen, and it does happen. And with that feeling of centered, of being centered and being settled in, there's still an ability to allow for things other than the breath. And so this is the type of concentration that we would hope to be developing here. Now, the purpose for developing this concentration is not just to develop a pleasant feeling or a concentrated feeling. It's not just to be able to sit for hours on end watching the breath. It's not just to be able to go through a 2-hour work period without thinking about anything other than the work. An important reason for developing this concentration and this quietness, this calmness, this feeling of settled in, and this openness to other things as well, is so that we can begin to investigate who we are. We can begin to inquire into who we are. And in fact, with this mindfulness of the breathing and with being with the contact, the touch sensation, and being with the walking meditation, although we're primarily working on concentration, we're also working on this inquiry. Because this type of inquiry isn't an intellectual inquiry. It's not a form of reflection. It's not using thought. It's not thinking about things or trying to work out things, trying to figure it all out, trying to come to answers about. But rather, it's just the bare experience of what is. The inquiry is just to be able to observe what is. And so we sit and we watch, and things come up, and we see them just as they are. And perhaps in this observation, perhaps in this direct experience, some understanding will arise. Some understanding that's beyond thought, that doesn't require words, that comes from a deeper place, a more intuitive place. And this understanding, which may arise, is insight. This is the insight that we refer to. In watching the breathing, watching the breath coming in and the breath going out, we begin to have insight. For most of us, most people, most of us begin to have some insight very quickly. And sometimes it's so obvious that we don't think of it as insight. We begin to see that the breath changes. Sometimes the breath is coming in, and sometimes the breath is going out. It's different. It's changing. Sometimes the breath comes in very deeply. Sometimes it comes in very shallow. Sometimes it feels warm. Sometimes it feels cool. Sometimes we feel that we want to change it. Sometimes it feels okay just the way it is. Sometimes the breath becomes very shallow, and there may be a feeling that there's no breathing at all, that the breath just isn't coming. And we also see perhaps that different activities affect the breath. So if we're chopping wood, the breath gets deeper, gets faster. If we're just sitting here very quiet and very still, the breath gets more shallow and gets slower. In certain emotional states, the breath changes in response to the mind, reaction to the mind. And in all this, perhaps we have the first understanding, the first insight of impermanence, of something changing, changing completely on its own, without anyone doing anything, without making any effort to change. It's just changing. And it's changing from moment to moment. And as we're watching the breath, we see that thoughts arise. So we're observing the breath, we're experiencing the breath, and suddenly a thought comes up. We didn't look for that thought. We didn't ask for the thought to come. It came. And we allow it to be there, and then we see that it goes away. And another thought may come and go, and other thoughts come and go. And one thought may come up, and it changes into another thought. And that one changes into another one, and it sets off a whole chain of changing thoughts. So we see that the thoughts also are changing. We don't have the same thought every single time that a thought comes up. They're different thoughts. The thoughts are changing. The mind is changing. And emotional states we see are changing. Sometimes we feel very happy. We're doing our practice, we're sitting in the meditation room, and things are going very well, and we're feeling very good, and we're thinking, wow, this is great stuff. I think I'll stay for a few days after this retreat. Or maybe we get a little bit more ambitious and say, well, I think I'm going to do a month retreat next. Or I'm going to go off and become a monk or a nun and live in a monastery and meditate for the rest of my life. And then we go off to a work period feeling very good and really positive about it. And we go through the work period and things are really good and still feeling good. And we come in for the next sitting and we sit down and boy, things just aren't going so well at all. And all of a sudden we start thinking, what am I doing here? I can't meditate. This stuff is no good. the mind, the emotional state, can change so quickly and for no apparent reason at all. We didn't do anything to make it change. We didn't invite the change. It changes. So the impermanence of the body, the impermanence of the mind, the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings. And then we look at material objects. If we think about material objects, our tendency is to think that things are going to last forever. But if we really look at them, we see that material objects don't last forever. They're always changing. This cushion I see has a hole in it, and pretty soon the stuffing's going to come out. It's changing. That cushion is not going to last forever. It will need some repairs. Gaia House, I think we're all getting quite familiar with, is constantly in need of repairs and additions and renovations and painting and cleaning. It's always changing. The house is always changing. I have a friend who was once in India. He was giving a discourse on impermanence to a Thai woman, and they were sitting on a concrete bench. And he was talking about impermanence, and he said, you know, we look at this concrete bench and it seems so permanent, it seems so solid, we think it's going to last forever. But everything is changing, including this concrete bench. And he brought his hand down on it, and the whole side of it just crumbled away. And inside, the reinforcing rods were all rusted and rotten. But things look so solid, and we look at them, and we make the assumption that they're going to last. But they don't. So these material objects are changing. And we see things, well, nature is constantly changing. The weather changes. I mean, yesterday was such a dull, dreary, cold day, and today is so beautiful. The sun's shining, and it's so warm and pleasant. It changes so quickly. And the leaves and the trees and the flowers change so quickly. You can walk around this hill. Probably every day you'll find something different, a different flower. Some flowers die, new flowers come into blossom. Berries begin to blossom and then begin to develop. So in nature, all these things changing. And then things like countries also changing. Something we identify, we tend to identify, or many people tend to identify quite strongly with their country. You say, I'm a Canadian, or I'm British, or whatever. But if we look at countries are also changing, change their boundaries, change their political allegiances, change their alliances, change their government philosophies, change their names. So things are always changing. And this changing, this constant change, this impermanence of all phenomena is the first insight that we can begin to have. And often is the first insight that we begin to have. And we begin to see, as we begin to see all this changing, we also perhaps begin to see how much we have invested in these things that are changing. And we start to see that we're developing dependency on these things and developing reliance and looking for security in them, but they're always changing. And we can start to see how, because of this, we feel dissatisfaction. We feel unhappy with things. We start to feel that perhaps we can't find so much security in these things because they're changing. Perhaps we can't rely on these things because they're changing. So a second quality of phenomena is this inability to find lasting satisfaction in things that are changing. Dissatisfaction of things because they're changing. This dissatisfaction is not only from change. It comes about, traditionally, this dissatisfaction is put into three classes. And the first of these classes is the unsatisfactoriness of things which in themselves appear to be unsatisfactory. So it's situations or things which clearly seem to be unsatisfactory, and we can very easily justify being unhappy with them. The most obvious of these is illness. So when we're sick, when the body is sick, or when the mind is ill, we can very easily justify our own feeling of dissatisfaction and say, well, it's because of this, it's obvious, it's because of this. Anyone who's sick feels miserable. Anyone who's sick is unhappy. It's completely because of the illness. But I wonder if that's really true. I remember working with a man who had cancer, who was dying of cancer, and the doctors had given him 2 or 3 weeks to live. And I used to go to the home, to his home. He was living with his sister and her husband. I used to go to the home and visit and work with him. And he was quite amazing. Here he was, the doctors had given him 2 or 3 weeks to live, and he had extremely painful cancer. And yet he was always bright and smiling and cheerful. And I'd come in and he'd say, oh, come in and sit down. And he'd say, anything you want to know about what I'm feeling or experiencing, ask me. And he's just so open and he just so much accepted his illness and accepted his condition that it didn't bother him. He had accepted his death. And none of this bothered him. And then there was his sister and his brother-in-law who were in apparently perfect health. And they just refused to talk to him. They couldn't accept that he was dying. And because of his illness, they were very sick. They were suffering. So the suffering, the dissatisfaction that comes with things that in themselves appear to be unsatisfactory. The second traditional type of dissatisfaction is the dissatisfaction that comes about because things change. We invest in something. We identify strongly with something. And then that thing suddenly changes. And we can't accept the change. We want it to stay the way that it was. And because we can't accept that change, because we want it to be the way it was, we're unhappy. We're dissatisfied. And this can show up in so many ways, just countless ways. Some very obvious and some not so obvious. Today, when lunch was a little bit late, how did everyone feel? Was anyone upset? Lunch is normally at 12:30. Today it was at about 12:40. At 12:30, were people waiting for the food, waiting for the bell to ring, wondering what was happening? And then at tea time, when tea was late, how was that? Was there the expectation? Was there the desire for it to be on time? If the food that's served at tea isn't up to expectation, or the food that's served at lunchtime, if it's not up to expectation, if it doesn't taste good, how does that feel? We've been getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. When I tell you that tomorrow morning we're getting up at 5:30, how does that feel? The situation changes. What have we got invested in sleeping in until 6 o'clock? relationships change. We're in a very loving relationship and having a wonderful time and things are going very well, and then something changes and the relationship breaks up. How do we feel? Can we accept that? Can we accommodate it? Can we work with it? Or do we suffer from it? We save up all our money and buy a beautiful new car. And then the neighbor comes along and buys a bigger car. Are we still happy with our little car, or do we want a bigger car as well? Situations change. The mind changes. We're feeling very good about the meditation, very positive about it, and want to do a month retreat or a 3-month retreat or a lifetime retreat. And then suddenly something happens, and suddenly that changes. How do we feel about it? Can we accommodate that? Or do we feel dissatisfaction with it? Do we start to criticize and judge ourselves and feel unworthy? Go for summer vacation or winter vacation and go somewhere where there's sun, somewhere other than England. And we get off the plane and immediately run to the beach and throw off our clothes and lie down. And the sun is just wonderful. It feels so good. It's so warm and wonderful. And I think, oh, I'm going to have a wonderful suntan, and I'll go back and everyone in England is going to be so pale. And then stay out in the sun a little bit too long and get burnt. The same beach, the same sun, the same body, but something has changed. Is there accommodating that, or is there suffering with that? Is there dissatisfaction with that? And then the third class of dissatisfaction is much more difficult to understand. It's very difficult to explain. It's much more subtle. And it's the dissatisfaction of self. The dissatisfaction of being. And this is a dissatisfaction which I feel underlies all dissatisfaction. It underlies all suffering. It's hard to think how to begin to explain it in any way. I'm sitting here, and we see this being sitting here at the front of the room, and we call this thing Norman. And I start to look at Norman, and I ask the question, what is Norman? And I look around, or I close my eyes and see what I can feel, and the thought comes up, okay, the body, this body is Norman. And then I can ask the question, okay, now, if I cut off an arm, is it still Norman? It's a different body. Is it still Norman? Or if I cut off a leg, is it still Norman? It's a different body, but our tendency would be to still call it Norman, even though it's something different. In seeing that it's something different, it's not the same, perhaps we can ask the question, well, if with two arms and two legs it's Norman, how can it also be Norman if one arm and one leg are missing? It's not the same thing. How can these two different things be the same thing? So we could perhaps, I'm not saying that we should, but we could perhaps come to the conclusion that the body isn't Norman. So then we could think a little bit more and look around and say, okay, well, the mind, with the body, we could also look back at photographs of Norman as a child. And we could see that the body then was very different than the body now. and yet we're still calling it the same Norman. But when you look at two photographs, it's obvious that it's not the same thing. So what's Norman? So then we can say, okay, well, it's not the body. Obviously, the body is changing so much. The body's always different. So it must be the mind. So we look at the mind, and we can do the same thing. We can see the mind is always changing. In this moment, the mind is one thing, and 5 minutes from now, the mind's going to be completely different. There's going to be totally different thoughts, completely different words coming out. So the mind is changing too. So can we say that the mind is Norman? And similarly with emotions, with feelings. They're changing. So where is Norman? So we could say that, okay, this what Norman is actually it's just this whole collection of things. It's the collection of the body and the mind and the feelings and the thoughts and all these things put together are Norman. So what if I change my name? What if I start calling myself Robert? Then where's Norman? And where's Robert? Or if I look at myself in relation to something or someone else. What's identified at Norman at any given time can very much be determined by the relationship to someone else or to something else. What Norman is could be identified by a role, a meditation teacher. Norman could be identified as the person who's in relationship with Peggy. Peggy is the woman who I live with. Norman could be identified as countless things that we could think of. So in any one moment, or in every moment, those things are actually changing. So sometimes this way, sometimes this way, sometimes identified by this, sometimes by that. So in all that, where's Norman? So we can begin to see that dissatisfaction can come about by trying to pin down who we are, trying to label who we are. If I grasp strongly onto the idea, or if I identify very strongly with being Norman, the meditation teacher, what happens if all of you get up and walk out? What happens to that role? What happens to my feeling about myself? And perhaps you identify yourselves as a meditator. Well, what happens if I leave? What happens if Gaia House burns down? We identify this as a retreat. We call what's going on here a retreat. But again, what happens if I leave? Where's the retreat? What happens if all of you leave? Where's the retreat? What happens if the cooks get up and walk out? Where's the retreat? We try to find an identity for something. We try to pin something down as being something lasting, something which has some permanent identity, something which has some identity and some existence independent of all the circumstances, independent of all the bits and pieces that make it up. And if we invest a lot into this, then when these conditions change, when these bits and pieces change, we're going to suffer. We're going to be dissatisfied. So the dissatisfaction of being. And this being, this belief in something which has an independent existence, which exists independently of other people, of other things, of other conditions, this belief that I have a permanent existence of any kind, that I exist as an independent being, is the third characteristic of phenomena. Actually, it's the opposite of the third characteristic. The first two characteristics are the impermanence and the unsatisfactoriness. And the third characteristic is that there is no independently existing self. And if we start to examine it intellectually, we can perhaps start to get some glimpse that perhaps there is some truth in this. Perhaps this is true. Perhaps my existence is dependent on your existence. The way I am right now is dependent on the way each one of you is right now. So this is the third characteristic, the third quality, this dependent existence. So we begin to see these characteristics in the practice, in the sitting, in watching the breath. We can start to see all these things. In our work periods, we can begin to see all these things. And beginning to see these things, beginning to ask these questions, beginning to have some doubts about my own existence, about the nature of my existence, beginning to have some doubts about the permanence of things, can be quite frightening. It brings up questions that perhaps we don't really want to ask. And perhaps we don't really want to look into. But the looking into it, the seeing, particularly the seeing of impermanence, the seeing that things are changing, the direct experience that things are not lasting, that we can't find any security in things, seeing that and experiencing that very clearly can help us to let go of our identification with things, help us to let go of our identification with roles, let go of our identification with relationships, let go of personal identification with names, let go of investing in things for security, for lasting security, for lasting peace, lasting happiness. And letting go doesn't mean throwing it away. Letting go, actually, it's not really a very good term, because it seems to me that letting go means, rather than getting rid of something, it actually seems to me that it means accommodating things. Letting go actually seems to me to be allowing things to be just as they are. Letting go of wanting to change them. Letting go of wanting to hold on to them. Just letting them be as they are. And if we can let things be just as they are, if we can allow things just to be, without grasping onto them, trying to keep them, trying to possess them, without trying to push them away, avoid them, hide them, ignore them. If we can see this dependent existence, if we can see, begin to see how our existence is not separate from the existence of anyone or anything else. If we can begin to see that the way I am is dependent on the way you are. If we can begin to see that there are so many conditions and so many factors making up Norman. And these things also are changing, so that we can let go of ideas of who Norman is and just see who I am in this moment and just allow that. And seeing that relationship, then perhaps we can also let go of the struggle to change. Let go of the need to change. The need to change ourselves. The need to change others. The need to make things different than they already are. The need to be perfect. The need to become something or someone. And if we can understand all that, then perhaps we can have an openness and an accommodation that can allow for a feeling of, or an understanding of, connectedness, of all being in this together, of all being dependent on one another. And with that, perhaps we can open up to loving kindness and to compassion, to helping one another, to being with one another. The Buddha was once asked by one of his disciples, would it be correct to say that the development of loving kindness and compassion is a part of this practice? And the Buddha said, no, that's not correct. What would be correct would be to say that the development of loving kindness and compassion is the practice. And it seems to me that the development of loving kindness and compassion is the understanding of impermanence, of dissatisfaction, and of not self. May all beings see into impermanence. May all beings see into dissatisfaction. May all beings see into not self.